We've spoken a lot about being mindful of the physical sensations of the body and about being mindful of the breath. And last night, Grove talked about being mindful of the hindrances and being mindful of mind states. But tonight, since we have been working on the mental landscape, tonight I'd like to talk about that sixth sense that we talked about. Remember, we mentioned in Buddhism there are six instead of five senses: hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, and the sixth being mind. So, as we talk about the mental landscape and mental events, and tonight I'm going to talk about thoughts, memories, and emotions, which are all part of the mental landscape. But it's important to note why there is so much emphasis put on being mindful of the breath, which is a bodily sensation, and being mindful of the body. Thoughts and memories and emotions are pretty nebulous things. They don't have any physical substance. And yet, they are so powerful in our lives. So it's really important to approach them from a place of being very grounded in our bodies. As many of you may have noticed already, it's really easy to get identified with what goes on in our minds. And it's not easy to slow down and actually be mindful of a thought or an emotion, because before we know it, it has spun out into a story or into a narrative. A number of years ago, I was on a retreat that Sharon Salzberg was teaching, and I went in for an interview with her, and I told her that I was just having relentless thoughts. I just couldn't get a handle on it. They were just coming one after another. And what she told me was a very classic Buddhist teaching, but it was so right for that moment. Sharon seems to have a knack of doing that, of just kind of penetrating with something very pithy and really saying the right thing for that moment. So what she said was a very classic Buddhist teaching. She said, if you want to cross a great ocean, you must first build a great vessel. If you want to cross a great ocean, you first have to build a great vessel. So in other words, what she was telling me was, in order to become mindful of your thoughts, you first have to be thoroughly grounded and thoroughly focused in what is the great vessel she was referring to. So being thoroughly focused and grounded in the breath. And that is the great vessel of attention that she's talking about. So what we're talking about when we talk about thoughts and when we talk about emotions, we're talking about something very intangible. We see the results of thoughts all the time, every day in our lives, every day in the world. We see the result of our own thoughts and other people's thoughts. But have you ever touched a thought? Have you ever seen a thought? You know, we see the results, but they're really nebulous, intangible things. In mythology, there's a really, what I think is a wonderful image for thought that sometimes represents thought. And that is the spider. You know, it may not seem quite obvious at first, but when you think about it, it's really a very appropriate image to represent a thought. And that is because the spider, when it spins its web, and lives in its wonderful web, the web is not in the air. It's not floating in an air, in the air. The spider doesn't live on the ground. It doesn't live in the water. It doesn't live on the water. It really lives somewhere out there in ephemeral and indefinite space. And yet, it's a really small and humble creature. But it spins these elaborate, intricate webs. And in mythology, sometimes it's considered a great creatrix goddess because it spins these incredible things out there kind of in nebulous space. So it really is like our thoughts. You know, we tend to spin these things, these huge, intricate things. We spin entire creations. We spin worlds just with our thoughts. So, again, thoughts have no inherent substance, and that they're really very powerful. And when we identify them, that's kind of what we're doing too, isn't it? You know, we're spinning these elaborate, intricate webs, interconnected webs of our thoughts and our narratives. So here we are as human beings, and we seem to be very identified with these intangible, nebulous things. And we're identified with them for a couple reasons. One is because it's very obvious. We are having them, right? We are having these thoughts. So, of course, they're mine. I own them. Who else's would they be? And secondly, and this is kind of double whammy, they're not only our thoughts, but they're often about us, right? So not only am I having the thought, but it's about me, so it must be true, right? What else could it be? So here we are with these mental constructions that we call thought. And if we're like most human beings, most of our thoughts are about us because we tend to be kind of self-absorbed. So the most important thing to note about thoughts is what Grove said this morning. And I think this bears repeating over and over and over again. Thoughts are not facts. Thoughts are not facts. They may be mine. I'm having them. They may be about me, but they are not facts in and of themselves. Thoughts can be used critically and analytically to arrive at facts, but that doesn't mean that they're facts by themselves. And this is especially true with thoughts about ourselves. Let's just imagine for a minute that you were magically able to tune in to the thoughts of a person sitting on the other side of the room during a meditation period. Now, if they have anything going through their minds like you might have going through your mind, would you think they were facts? I mean, we all know what goes through our mind when we're sitting there. But would you think that they're just kind of miscellaneous stuff floating through someone else's head? They're not facts. Early on in my practice, I used to have this little exercise that I created for myself and around thoughts. And what I would do is every morning when I woke up in the morning, I'd get up to brush my teeth and I'd look in the mirror and I would try to notice the first thought that I had about myself. And then as the day went on, I'd notice another thought about myself. And as the day progressed, there would be another thought. And then at the end of the day, I would try to go over some of these thoughts. I would just kind of make a mental note of them. And they would range from, "Ooh, you look awful today," to, "Oh, you're really having a good day. This is going to be a good day." Or to, "You don't do anything right." Or, "This is really stellar. You know, you really handled that situation well." And after I did this for several days of just going over the thoughts that I had about myself, I would say to myself, "Okay, you've had all these thoughts about yourself. There's a wide variety of thoughts. They're pretty contradictory. Which one is true? Which one is really you?" And what it taught me was that thoughts were really not a very reliable source of information about myself. So these judgments that we have, especially these judgments that we have about ourselves, really don't have a lot of reality in the outside world. You know, that's why we have friends and family and teachers and therapists to help us get some kind of an objective view. As a matter of fact, if the thoughts about ourselves are either very negative or very inflated, we can be almost absolutely sure that they are not correct. So if our thoughts about ourselves are either very negative or very inflated, we can be pretty sure that they're not correct. So as we do this practice, we can actually learn to let the thoughts just be there instead of trying to analyze them or get rid of them, to just allow them to be there. We don't have to give them a power that they don't have. Look at the results of thoughts when people decide to act on them. I can't think of any really negative social situation in the world that didn't start with a thought, or any positive social situation in the world that didn't start with a thought. Someone had a thought, and the next thing you know, there's a war. Or the next thing you know, there's a fabulous invention, or a fortune is being created, or a fortune is being lost, because someone had a thought and decided to act on it. So thoughts, just like everything else, can have positive or negative effects. And in saying this, I'm not saying, you know, that we should try to get rid of thoughts. The important thing is to be mindful of our thoughts, to be aware of what's going on. And as we start to become mindful of our thoughts, we see that they're just that. They're just thoughts. They're these mental events that are constantly, continuously flowing and floating through our heads. And what we start to learn is that there is enormous difference between having a thought and engaging with a thought. We don't have to engage with every thought that's floating through our head. We don't have to grab onto it and create a narrative around it. And more importantly, we don't have to act on every thought we have. You know, if we think we own all these thoughts, especially the ones about ourselves, then action becomes kind of natural. But if we start to understand that we don't really have to engage every thought that goes through our head, then we can start to kind of liberate ourselves from this ownership. So we can learn to note them, just like we did the sensations in our body, or just like we do with the breath. We can note them. There's an angry thought. There's a thought about the past. There's a thought about the future. there's a thought about myself. There's a judgment. There's a judgment about myself. There's that same running commentary going on. There's that same story over and over and over again. A friend of mine used to, he liked the "Play It Again, Sam" version. Every time he heard that, the same story floating through his head, he'd just say, "Play it again, Sam." That was kind of his note that he would give to things. So we can learn with thoughts. We can learn to be kind of playful with them. We can learn to just enjoy this passing show that's continually floating through our minds. So sometime, and maybe you already tried this today, maybe you were able to see a thought arise, or maybe you were able to catch a thought right in the middle. And next time that happens, if you're able to do that, see if you can stay with the thought until it disappears, until it's just gone into space. I think that the first time that we're able to see a thought in this way, that we're able to see a thought disintegrate, brings an incredible sense of freedom in our lives. To know all of a sudden that these things that we're so identified with and have so much power over us are nothing but puffballs. You know, have you ever seen a puffball on a mushroom that you poke it and it just turns into nothing? So they come and they go and they just disappear into nothingness. And the first time that we're able to notice that, to really experience it, is such a freeing moment in our lives. So knowing that we can choose to engage a thought or just let it float by. As a metaphor, we might think of our minds as a four-story house. The first floor is that ground floor where our thoughts and our sensations and our brain receiving information from the outside world and from our own inside world. That's the first floor in the house. The second floor is what we call a feeling tone, a sense of our experience as pleasant. Does it have a pleasant tone to it? Does it have an unpleasant tone to it? Or neither one. Maybe it's just blah. So there's kind of a feeling tone. And then the third floor is the floor of perception. And we've talked a little bit about perception. And, you know, these things, they happen in a nanosecond. They happen so fast that we hardly notice them, that we go from sensation to feeling to perception. But what perception talks about is it's what our minds know from what's perceived through our senses. And then the mind immediately starts to put that into categories. You know, there's a big green blob out there. It's a tree. Obviously it's a tree. Because 1,000 times in my life, I've looked out that window and I've seen a big green blob and it's a tree. So I put a label on that. I call it tree. So I just assume that it's a tree. But as you might notice, there's a little bit of possibility of error here. And we talked about that a little bit night before last, about all the studies that were done on perception. And sometimes with perception, we see a big green blob, and it might be an air balloon landing out there. I don't know. It might not be a tree. And then the fourth floor is that thinking and talking part of our brain. It's the place where there's creativity, analysis, critical ability, problem solving. But it's also the place where there's all this kind of obsessive, repetitive stuff going on. All these kind of stories that we keep running. So it's that place that's often not very interesting, you know, that's obsessive with its thoughts, has the same thought over and over again. And we might think of mindfulness as kind of an elevator that goes up and down in this four-story house. But that first floor is really the most grounded place to live. It's the place where our firsthand experience takes place in our minds and in our bodies. And what mindfulness does is it helps us to come back over and over to our most grounded experience in our bodies, to our actual experience that's felt and lived in the moment. And that's why there's so much emphasis put on in being in the body. Because no matter where we are in this four-story house, if we're up there with our thoughts flying all over the place and narratives and obsessive thinking, we can just get in the elevator and go back down to the ground floor and check in with our most grounded felt experience in our lives. So no matter what the mind is lost in, it's important always, even if we're doing mindfulness of thinking, it's always important to drop back into the body and check it out. See what's going on in present time in our body. So in our daily lives and in our formal practice, in our sitting practice, we can make a choice on which kind of thoughts we want to really engage and act on. The difficult negative thoughts that come up, we can acknowledge them and just let them float through. And then the question comes up, well, what kind of thoughts should we be acting on? Well, thoughts that come up that are really wholesome and positive. Thoughts of kindness, of caring, of generosity are those thoughts that it's always safe to act on. There's never a question there. And the others, we can just let go. We don't really need them, these negative judgments about ourselves. This is a quote from the Buddhist texts. The thought manifests as the word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit, and the habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love, out of concern for all beings. Watch the thought and its ways with care. So now I want to go on and talk about memory. From my own experience, memory is more than just a thought about the past. A thought about the past is something like, I went over to Bob's house yesterday and had lunch. But a memory is something that's a little bit more engaging than just a thought about the past. It's about the past, but it's kind of compelling and engaging and captivating in ways that thoughts about the past aren't. You know, there's so much brain study going on now and so much brain study connected with meditation practice and so forth. And when brain researchers started getting all of this new equipment to study the brain, they thought, wow, now we get to see what really happens with memory. We get to see where all these minute details are stored in the brain. But surprise, they found out that it was really something quite different than they had expected. And actually, in many ways, far more simple. What they discovered is that in memory, the brain only stores the key features of an experience. It does not store every detail. Sometimes these key features are called flashpoints because they usually have a strong emotional component. Obviously, our brains could not store every detail that ever happened in our lives. They would explode. There wouldn't be any room for any new material in our brains if it stored every single detail from our past. And even though computers are an attempt to replicate some of the functions of the brain, our brains are not computers. Sometimes we tend to think they are computers, but our brains are not computers. They're much different. What a computer does is calls up things from a hard drive, exactly as it was inputted into a computer. But our brains are not like that at all, especially with memories. What the brain does is it calls up the key features of a memory. And then what it does is it takes those key features and it kind of adds other materials that seem kind of right for the moment. It sort of fills in all the gaps around these flashpoints. And of course this happens with such lightning speed that we don't see it. There's a flashpoint, and then all of a sudden there's all this other stuff that starts to come into the brain. And I don't know if you've noticed this, and since I learned it, I've started to sort of look at it a little bit. But each time a memory comes up, it's a little bit different because we're adding all this other material in different ways each time. So that word to remember is really a very appropriate word, you know, to re-member. That's what memory is. It's trying to put all these different pieces back together into some kind of a whole. So it comes up every time a memory comes up, it comes up a little bit differently, and the gaps are filled in a little bit differently each time. This is what the psychologist Peter Levine says about memory. Rather than recording a linear sequence of events, memory is more like playing with Mr. Potato Head. Depending on how it feels at the time, the mind selects from colors, images, smells, interpretations, and responses with similar arousal and feeling tones, then brings them to the foreground in various combinations to produce what we call memory. So this makes memory somewhat different than just a thought about the past. So each time we remember an event, this kind of re-imaging is happening. And I guess the first thing that comes to mind is that makes memory not totally reliable. So if we're expecting our memories to give us an exact picture of what happened in the past, it's just not going to happen because it's going to be a little bit different. So every time a memory is triggered by an emotion, it's really reimagined a little bit differently each time. And the basic emotional tone may be the same, but the details are filled in just a little bit differently. And memory, just like thoughts, has no intrinsic substance of its own. It's a very nebulous, ephemeral thing that's happening. You can't put your finger on it. And yet, look at the power that memories have. They can make us sad. They can make us happy. They can make us lonely. They can make us joyful. They can make us feel nostalgic. So this is a lot of power for something that really has no intrinsic substance. The other thing about memory that I think is important to note is that sometimes when there is a strong memory, it can feel like we are actually back in a certain situation in our lives, that we're actually reliving the past. And memories can often suck us into events that are long past in our lives, that are long gone. A friend of mine related this story to me. She shared it with me about a 6-week retreat that she did. She was sitting at the Insight Meditation Society, and all through the retreat, she was just flooded with memories, just absolutely, totally vivid memories over and over and over again. And memories actually became the theme of that retreat. That's all there was, is just this flood of memories continuing to come. So she went and she talked to her teacher about it. And her teacher said, all you have to do is simply note memory being known. You don't have to get caught up in it. You don't have to try to figure it out. Every time a memory comes up, just make a soft mental note. And she did this. She made a soft mental note every time a memory came up. And what happened is, as the retreat progressed, she started to feel so much pain around all of the memories that were coming up, which was she didn't really understand why this was happening, because the content of the memories was not painful. It wasn't sad. It was just having the memory itself felt really, really sad to her. So as she sat there, she slowly began to understand what was happening as she noted over and over memory being known. She noticed that with each memory that came up, and maybe with memories in general, there was just this kind of low-grade level of delusion that was going on, this delusion about the past. A delusion that we often have, that the past really isn't quite over, that somehow we can go back and relive it. It's not really obvious, but it's just this kind of low-grade sense, especially when memories are really vivid. So in just acknowledging that the past was gone, that it could not be relived, brought up a lot of pain and a lot of freedom at the same time. So she noticed that there was a lot of pain in just letting go of this delusion about the past. And we know that the past is gone, and the future hasn't arrived, and we cannot relive the past, even through memory. So just simply noticing when a memory arises, memory being known, sad memory being known, happy memory being known, joyful memory being known. Just simply noting what's going on. This is from the Buddha. He said, not reviving the past and not hoping to be in the future. Instead, with insight, see each arising state. Not reviving the past and not hoping to be in the future. Instead, with insight, see each arising state. Some people, indeed, do have perfect recall. Maybe you're one of those people. But for most of us, you know, we don't remember. We don't have perfect recall. And we don't remember everything that has gone on. So for most of us, when thoughts and memories about the past come up, our memories really are not that reliable. So how can we deal with strong memories when they arise? Well, we can greet them. Just as we would a physical sensation or anything else. And again, the content of the memory is not what is important. It's just noticing that it is a memory. Noticing perhaps that it's different than a thought. Noticing that kind of compelling sense about memory that just kind of pulls us back into past events. So if a memory arises, for instance, of your kindergarten teacher or your first date, having a memory about your kindergarten teacher or your first date is remembering. But being aware that you are having a memory about your kindergarten teacher or your first date is mindfulness. It switches from just remembering to mindfulness simply by bringing awareness to it, by knowing that it is indeed a memory. So mindfulness can be turned towards any experience. It can be turned towards thoughts, memories, emotions, sensations. So the practice is not about evaluating the content of what's going on in our minds. It's just noting what is that there is something going on in our minds and noting it in an impersonal way. There's a memory about the past. There's a happy memory. So memories and emotions are really closely related. Emotions tend to trigger memories. But emotions in and of themselves are a little bit different yet. Have you ever wondered where that word emotion comes from? It's kind of a funny word, isn't it? Emotion. It's not an internet site like e-commerce or emotion. I didn't really wonder about it until I started really exploring emotions. By their very nature, emotions tend to kind of spin us around and pull us in 10 different directions at once. And the word emotion actually means something that sets the mind in motion. So it has to do with motion. You know, we could say that thoughts are very persistent. Memories may be compelling. But emotions can sometimes be totally overwhelming. I think of these three things, thoughts, memories, and emotions. Emotions can be the most overwhelming. The psychologist Carl Jung used to like to say, do we have emotions or do emotions have us? Do we have emotions or do emotions have us? And I think it's more often that emotions have us rather than us having emotions. And in the Buddhist teachings, you know, they really don't talk a whole lot about emotion in the Buddhist teachings. They talk more about mind states. But of course, when you're caught in an emotion, the distinction between an emotion and a mind state really is not that important. You're just kind of caught in the emotion. But I think in the Buddhist description as a mind state, there's really a clue as to what's going on there. What the clue is that they are states, that they're not personal, that they're passing events, that they don't belong to us. And when we identify them with them is when we tend to get in trouble. Just seeing them as passing events, it's easy. They come and they go. And this is true for thoughts and memories as well. They're not personal. They're just mental events. And sometimes it's really helpful to note emotions in a very impersonal way. I know this was really a great aid in my own practice when I started noting in this way. Instead of saying, I'm angry, I'm happy, I'm sad, to say, there is sadness arising. There is happiness arising. There is anger arising. To depersonalize it. You know, if they were personal, we would be able to call them up and get rid of them at any time that we wanted, right? If we really had control over these. If they weren't just these passing mental events. So they are impersonal. They're not ours. So there's no point in noting them as personal events. There's anger arising. There's ill will arising. Usually, and I think this is one of the things that makes an emotion different than a thought, an emotion has a very strong physical component to it. And in addition to that, there usually isn't much middle ground in emotions. They're either positive or negative in one direction or another. Like sorrow, joy, love, hate. You know, we don't have too many blah emotions, do we? They're usually pretty polarized. So an emotion involves thought, and it involves a physical component as well. I like this definition of emotion. I think I got this out of Webster's, I think. A moving of the mind. Excitement of feelings, whether pleasing or painful. Disturbance or agitation of the mind caused by a specific cause and manifested by some sensible effect on the body. Disturbance or agitation of the mind caused by a specific exciting cause and manifested by some sensible effect on the body. A really good example that of an emotion that I would like to talk about a little bit tonight is that of fear. It's a pretty good example of this mental and physical component both happening at once and setting the mind in motion. This thing that excites the mind and sets it in motion. Last night, Grove talked about the hindrances, and he talked about aversion. And fear is actually comes under the category of aversion in the Buddhist cosmology. Fear is part of the hindrance of aversion. And in the Buddhist psychology, it sees fear and anger as very similar energies. But it sees anger as a really kind of fast-burning boil that's directed outward, and fear as a slow boil that is directed inward. So they're all part of the hindrance of aversion. And they all, anything that involves aversion, involves some kind of contraction. So if you're feeling a contraction in the mind and in the body, it's probably aversion going on. That's how we experience aversion. So fear is a good example of an emotion. Fear is always about something that has not happened yet. When we are in the midst of a very difficult situation, fight or flight or immobility are the things that arise. Fear usually does not arise in that moment. So fear is always about the future. So there's always a thought about the future involved with fear. What could happen? And not only is it a thought about the future, it's a thought about the narrowing of possibilities in the future. It's a thought about the worst possible outcome of a situation. So there's the thought part of fear. That's where our mind goes. It goes to the future, and it goes to limiting the possibilities in the future. Then there's also the physical component. If we drop into our bodies when we're experiencing fear, we may experience heat in the body. We may experience the heart pounding. We may experience lightheadedness. So there's both a mental and a physical component in an emotion. And the more the body feels the physical component, the more the mind races. Has this ever happened to you with fear? You know? The more the mind gets going with all of its stories, the more we feel it in the body. The more we feel it in the body, the more the mind starts racing. And the more it feels like there's something real that's happening. But all it is an event that is going on simultaneously, spinning through the mind and the body at the same time. So the most important thing to do, as with any emotion, is to drop into our physical sensations and explore what's going on, to explore the nature of the narrative that's going on. So this is dropping back into that ground floor that I talked about in the four-story house, the place where we are actually closest to our felt experience. What's the emotion in the body? What thoughts and narratives are going on during an emotion? You know, like, I'm never going to get over this. Everything always turns out the same. My life is boring. Notice some of the narrative that's going on that keeps replaying itself over and over again. So what's needed here is not trying to figure it out. Not even trying to figure out the object of the fear. It doesn't help in that moment because it's about the future. So sometimes with emotion, what's kind of interesting is to note an emotion over and over and over again until we see it dissipate. Even if it takes an entire sitting to just sit there and notice anger, 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 anger until we can see it dissipate. Because this starts to let us know that this is not permanent, that this is just a passing ephemeral event going on in our minds and on our bodies. So emotions are, they're very powerful. They're very overwhelming. But just like everything else, they come and they go. This is a little tool that Michelle McDonald, who teaches here in the summertime, She kind of invented this little tool to work with hindrances or to work with emotion. And it's the word rain. It's something that you can use as a mnemonic device. It's the word rain. So R, and Grove talked about this last night, is to recognize what's going on. There's fear. There's anger. There's sadness. To recognize it. And then the A stands for acceptance. To accept it. Not to say, I'm doing a spiritual practice. I should not be feeling ill will. Right? Or I've got to get rid of this. But just to accept. This is being present. This is how the Dharma is presenting itself in this moment. Accepting whatever is going on. And then the I stands for investigation. Start to investigate what's going on. What is the nature of anger? What does it feel like in the body? What does it feel like when I remove the object? When I understand that it's not about the object? And I start really exploring the nature of this, when I explore the nature of the wanting mind. And then the N stands for non-identification. That it's really impersonal, what's going on. It's not something we have to identify with. We can just note it as a passing event. A Tibetan mystic once said that he was not impressed by someone who could turn the floor into the ceiling or turn fire into water. A real miracle, he said, was if someone could liberate just one negative emotion. A real miracle is liberating one negative emotion. Let's just sit together for a few minutes. We'll have walking meditation now until a quarter till. Looks like the wind has died down a little.
Just to confirm for everybody's information, the smoke that we are experiencing is from a fire way, way south down in the Gila in southern New Mexico, a big fire there. There's nothing anywhere near us that's a fire, but it's a major fire in the south and is sweeping up across New Mexico and parts of Colorado. But nothing for us to be in fear of.
Is it going in Colorado?
Yeah, it's going in Colorado. The smoke.
The smoke
is. The smoke is, yeah. The fire is only in the healing.